speeches in American history as President Kennedy's inaugural address in 1960. With the Cold War accelerating towards a catastrophe that almost came in October 1962, Kennedy proposed a new beginning, addressing, quote, those nations who would make themselves our adversary, the president offered, not a pledge but a request that both sides begin anew, the quest for peace. Cognizant that cynics might misunderstand his intent, President Kennedy reminded all those listening that civility is not a sign of weakness and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. These simple words convey the character of American foreign policy properly understood and were echoed recently by President Obama, who promised even, quote, those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist. I'm pleased today that we're joined by Acting Assistant Secretary of State Jeffrey D. Feltman, who returned recently from an effort to put into action this approach to our national security. If anyone can deliver the message that engagement with Syria will not be paid for in Lebanese coin, and this is a message that needs to be repeated again and again, it is Ambassador Feltman. America's interests in Lebanon can easily be summed up: sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. We want Lebanon to be ruled by the Lebanese, for the Lebanese, a pluralistic democracy in landscape mostly occupied by strongmen and tyrants. Lebanon is sadly a canary in the Middle East coal mine. If Lebanon can be free, if Lebanon can find space for all the different voices and religions and convictions within it, if Lebanon can continue to exist with one foot in the West and the other in the Arab world, if Lebanon can simply be a normal country and not a battleground for outside powers, then our interests, and I think those of most Lebanese, will be fully satisfied. We seek a partner, not an outpost. We want an ally, not a proxy. And we must continue to aid those Lebanese committed to their country's freedom from foreign rule or domination. Lebanon is approaching a crossroads. The elections, which will take place in June, will have a powerful effect on the country's future, and I believe that we and Lebanon's friends in the international community must be vigilant and active in the days leading to the contest. The real work of winning the election must be done in Lebanon by the Lebanese. It is their campaign to run, it is their future on the line, and it is their message that must resonate with their electorate. One side can offer a future of peace and prosperity. The other can promise only dogma and destruction. But unless the forces of progress achieve real coordination and meaningful compromise with each other, their prospects for both before and after the election will be greatly diminished. The United States cannot and should not interfere in the election. The campaign and the election are for the Lebanese to succeed or fail on their own. But neither should we be impassive. There is much that we can do and should do on the outside to demonstrate that Lebanon's future is not dependent on either militias or mullahs. The special tribunal for Lebanon has begun, and the United States must continue to be a strong advocate for this body. More significantly, in addition to providing funds for its operation, American diplomats in every country in context must continue to insist on the tribunal's continued importance and on the validity of its work. Especially in the Middle East, there is a tendency to believe that there is a reality behind reality. So, in word and deed, we must continue to make clear that there is no deal on the tribunal, and there will be no deal on the tribunal. Period. Full stop. We need to continue and enhance our support for the Lebanese Armed Forces, the LAF, and the Internal Security Forces, the ISF. These institutions enjoy strong support throughout Lebanon and have a pressing mission in battling terrorists activated and armed by foreign powers. I'm a strong proponent of maintaining Israel's qualitative military advantage, but there is no nothing that we are providing to the LAF and the ISF that has or will endanger Israel's defense capabilities. There is a very large space between the capabilities needed to effectively challenge the IDF and those needed to tackle a terrorist group like the Fatah al-Islam, and in 2007 held off the LAF for 3 months in the Nahr al-Bared camp. Even erring on the side of caution, something in which I would insist, the LAF has real needs that I believe we can help fill without endangering Israel. But we also need to look closely at the points of friction between Israel and Lebanon, which pose a significant risk to regional security. One thing we should have learned about the Arab-Israeli conflict is that it rarely gets better on its own, and that problems left unresolved don't ameliorate but fester. The United States needs to initiate and lead a process to help resolve the immediate conflicts over borders and territory, Lebanese airspace, and locating unexploded munitions from 2006. Doing so will not only demonstrate that diplomacy works, but that American assistance can improve security for all sides. What we, our friends in Lebanon, need to offer is hope, not as a method for solving problems, but as a source of energy and a reason for continuing to struggle for something much better. Lebanon's future is not yet written. It does not have to be one of civil war and foreign conflict. Lebanon's best and brightest shouldn't have to leave the country in order to live normal lives. Lebanon's landscape doesn't need to be scarred with wreckage and its leaders not live in fear of their very lives. None of that is necessary. But the Lebanese people will have to choose to make it so. And if they do, they should have no better a partner in their efforts than the United States. Mr. Rohrabacher.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I am today sitting in for Mr. Burton, who is engaging in debate on the floor of the House. However, I would have been preparing anyway, as I am a member of the committee. So let me just a few thoughts in the opening statement for myself and not for Mr. Burton, although I'm here in his place. Mr. Chairman, you just mentioned the concept that President Obama expressed during the election. It's one of the issues he brought up, which is not being afraid to talk to anyone. And let me note that Ronald Reagan had that strategy as well. Ronald Reagan said, very clearly, that we should be very nice to people and be willing to talk, but very tough when it comes to policy. And I've always agreed with that concept, but not being afraid to talk is something totally different than making sure that when you speak to a dictatorship or a group of gangsters, that you are doing so responsibly and in a way that will not bolster the position of those evildoers, so to speak. Simply expressing our openness and trying to reach out to a totalitarian regime will not make it better. The Iranian mullahs, for example, know exactly what their position is. We're not trying to fool them, they're not trying to fool us. And I'm afraid that by thinking that we are going to sway them by some sort of benevolent expressions or by including their own description of their regime may have horrible consequences. For example, by suggesting for the first time that the people of Iran are ruled by a legitimate government, by referring to them as the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran rather than just the Iranian people, perhaps what we've done is demoralize the very people in Iran who we want to have as our closest allies. And I would hope that any contact that we have with Syria does not make the same mistake of having position that seems to verify the legitimacy of the tough guys who we're talking to. Let me note that we have with us today a young man who led the demonstrations at the universities in Iran 10 years ago. He is a young man who has been very active in resisting and organizing resistance to the Mullah since then. And I'd like to just have Mr. Roosevelt please stand up. Right there, young man, a courageous young man who is standing against the Mullah dictatorship in Iran. Thank you for joining us here today. We have to make sure that people like this young man who live in Syria are not demoralized, who want democracy for their country. The people throughout the Middle East who want to have peace and prosperity and democracy and want to live not only peace with their neighbors, but want to be part of a global system of harmony and justice, that we do not demoralize those people. And what I am afraid of is that if we try to bend over backwards too far with Syria, and we become just too sincere in our openness and expressions to the Syrian leadership, thinking that that's what will sway them, it will have the opposite impact, because it will demoralize those people in Syria who, too, would like to be friends of the United States and friends of democracy and live at peace with the world. I would suggest, first of all, to note, and this will shock some of my friends, that we do have to recognize that Lebanon was in chaos and confusion and bloodshed before the Syrian intervention. And if we expect the Syrians to listen to us, we should understand and recognize that. But what happens when a non-democratic government interferes with military force? And it did some good right off the bat by ending that chaos and bloodshed that was going on unabated in Lebanon. What happens if someone overstays their welcome and stays too long is eventually the situation deteriorates. And clearly now, Syria is playing and has been playing for a number of years a highly negative role in Lebanon. And we need to tell the Syrians and make it clear to them, if we have, if we're going to just talk with anybody, let's be tough on policy. We no longer can tolerate the type of assassinations and interference that Syria has been doing in Lebanon. And if there's going to be a peace, a bigger peace, and a greater peace in the Middle East, and democracy, and there's going to be some kind of an order established, yes, Syria has to be included, but we know that it must be based on respecting the rights of the people of Lebanon to run their own country, and that has to be respected and demanded by the United States in our negotiations with Syria. With that, I am looking forward to hearing a first-hand report giving us an update as to where these discussions might go, what are the chances for success, and the upcoming elections, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, are something that we should be making sure that we focus on those elections and make sure that they are a success and that outside forces like those in Syria do not manipulate this turning point in Lebanese history. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking forward to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Rohrabacher. I'll just note that whenever you quote Ronald Reagan, knowing that you were one of his speechwriters, I don't marvel at the fact that you don't look down to read the quote that he said. Mr. Costa.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking forward to hearing the testimony from our witness, and I'll defer.
Mr. Allison.
Thank you for holding the hearing, Mr. Chair. I look forward to hearing from the witnesses, and I want to welcome the ambassador here with us and look forward to what he would have to share with us. I'm particularly interested in the reopening of the Hariri investigation, and also I have an interest in learning about I guess there were two Palestinian leaders who were killed in Lebanon recently. I'd like to know what the ambassador can share with us about that subject, and then also what prospects for U.S.-Syrian, Lebanon-Syrian relations can take place. Anxious to hear about his recent trip to Syria that the States and saving one. So again, thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I actually wait to hear your remarks.
Mr. Fortenberry. Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, to say welcome, Mr. Ambassador. Last time we met a number of years ago in Lebanon, you were confined to your job, so to speak. It's nice to see you were able to come on, so welcome today. Mr. Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ambassador, for joining us today. We had the chance, Chairman, and a number of us, to travel to Beirut a couple of months ago to see firsthand, meet with the military leaders, meet with the political leaders, and obviously looked at Lebanon as a very interesting laboratory, a place where hopefully democracy can thrive. There's a lot of good efforts going in. A lot of concern, of course, about the election coming up, and the, if you will, the free will of the people, and if Hezbollah ends up with more seats in the parliament, what impact does this have? The government there is quick to distinguish between the Hezbollah, that is the political participant, and the Hezbollah, which you know, creates what many of us believe is a terrorist threat in the region. And we'd be curious as to a couple of questions. Number one, as I said, what would be the response the United States government should have in the event of an election in which Hezbollah wins a majority or controlling interests of the parliament? Number two, what is your thinking on the mandate of UNIFIL and whether it is effectively preventing the rearmament of Hezbollah in the southern area, and what can be or should be done on the part of the United Nations and the United States efforts in that regard? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and again, thank you for holding this very important hearing. We all know that after 30 years of civil war, Lebanon is actively undertaking the effort to build a safe and more stable state for its citizens with the help from the United States. Siamese defeat for Lebanon, whose weak military and even weaker central government has allowed foreign-backed groups to set up shop within its borders and drag its band into wars with Israel. Mr. Chairman, I support the notion of building state institutions in Lebanon and encouraging reform through the use of foreign assistance. A stronger Lebanon should replace the current security vacuum which exists and allows for Hezbollah to thrive. But until Lebanon is in a position to productively manage this assistance and its institutions, I would like to be certain that U.S. assistance will not add to the vacuum by somehow reaching the hands of Hezbollah. In addition to supporting Lebanon, we also have to work with our allies to diminish the role of Syria in Lebanese politics and civil society. Syria, and ultimately Iran's financial and political influence over Hezbollah, is a major impediment to a normal and successful Lebanese civil society. Lebanon is already making strides towards an active democracy with its parliamentary elections in June, but as former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said, democracy has to deliver. People want to vote and eat. So the question is, what can be done to make the non-Hezbollah parts of the Lebanese government be in a position to deliver? The United States must take special care to not only monitor assistance, but help Lebanon to eliminate corruption. I look forward to our distinguished guest testimony and look forward to him addressing these concerns. Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your leadership on these issues, and I yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you. The chair would make a unanimous request that the gentleman from California, Mr. Issa, be permitted to sit with the committee and participate as if he were a member of the committee. Seeing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Issa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the unanimous consent, and thank you for the opportunity to be back on a committee that I regretfully am on leave of absence from. In the years that I've served on the committee, in the years that I've known the ambassador, I found him to be fair, honest, and knowledgeable of the issues, first of Israel and the Palestinians, then Lebanon in all its complexity and its mosaic of different issues, whether it's how to get Walid Jumblatt to be solidly with you, or, in fact, how to get the press to believe that you are pulling the strings of all the decisions made by all the elected and unelected officials in Lebanon. And few know just how much the press loved to hate you as you wormed our way through a solution to the 2006 war, as you dealt with the post-war challenges, and a prime minister who would gladly have left for retirement if not for the continued support of the United States. So I look forward to an update on where you see opportunity in the Levant. Yes, Lebanese-centric would be very important, but as we all know, Lebanon touches all of the tentacles, if you will, of the Middle East problems. Certainly no peace is possible without Syria, but certainly as long as Syria has an influence in Lebanon that is less than productive, no peace will happen in that country either, either for the people of Lebanon or, in fact, for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have had to call refugee camps their home for their entire lives. So, Mr. Chairman, I look forward to this very knowledgeable ambassador who can obviously link together the challenges that Lebanon faces, but also the challenges and opportunities within the region, and would ask unanimous consent to have the rest of my statement put in the record.
Without objection.
I yield back.
Now, we could not hope to have a more expert witness than Ambassador Jeffrey D. Felt. Ambassador Feltman, since December 18, 2008, has been the Acting Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, and has been Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary since February 11, 2008. Before that, Ambassador Feltman served for 3 years and 9 months as the U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon, a career member of the U.S. Foreign Service since January 1986. Before his posting in Lebanon, Ambassador Feltman headed the Coalition Provisional Authority, their office in Erbil, and simultaneously served as Deputy Regional Coordinator for CPA's Northern Area. From August 2001 until December 2003, Ambassador Feltman served as the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem, first as Deputy Principal Officer, and then from July 1, 2001 until September 2002 as Acting Principal Officer. In addition to a number of staff positions in Washington, Ambassador Feltman has also served in Tel Aviv, Tunisia, Hungary, and Haiti. So we're all delighted to welcome him back to the subcommittee today. Ambassador, you may proceed. Your entire statement will be made a part of the official record, and you can proceed as you would.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to thank you in particular for your leadership on the issue of Lebanon. I'd also like to thank the entire committee for its role in supporting the concept of a free and democratic Lebanon. Also like to thank the former members of the committee for their role in Lebanon. President Obama and Secretary Clinton have demonstrated our continuing and unwavering support for a sovereign, democratic, and prosperous Lebanon, the type of Lebanon that the members of this committee have just described as being our objective. And we continue to seek full implementation of all of the UN Security Council resolutions on Lebanon, and we will continue our efforts to strengthen the institutions of the Lebanese state. We are also seeking to advance a comprehensive regional peace. Lebanon will play a key role in the long-term effort to build lasting stability and peace in the Middle East. Many of you have mentioned the upcoming elections. Lebanon's June 7th parliamentary elections offer an opportunity for moderate voices in Lebanon to continue their support for a sovereign, stable, independent, and democratic Lebanon. It's worth noting that Lebanon, alone among the Arab countries, has two former presidents who continue to live in Lebanon, two former chiefs of state who continue to live in Lebanon as a sign of the vibrancy of Lebanon's democracy. In terms of the elections, we continue to urge all parties to support the conduct of free, fair, and transparent elections unmarred by violence. With the strong support of the U.S. Congress, the U.S. has provided $10.5 million for a number of programs to help Lebanon improve its ability to carry out these fair, transparent elections. In terms of the results of these elections, the elections will hinge on a handful of seats located primarily in Christian-dominated areas of Lebanon. How the Christian voters divide between the two main political blocs, the March 14th bloc and the March 8th bloc, will determine who has the majority in the next parliament and the next cabinet. Decisions on the shape and the composition of the next government that will come out of these parliamentary elections should and can be made by the Lebanese themselves, for Lebanon, free from outside interference. In terms of our own role, we and
anticipate that the shape of the United States assistance, United States policies toward Lebanon, will be evaluated in the context of Lebanon's parliamentary election results, and especially by the policies adopted by the new cabinet. Some of you have mentioned the threat of Hezbollah. We remain extremely concerned about the role that Hezbollah is playing in Lebanon. The group continues to receive weapons from Syria and Iran in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701, the resolution that led to the cessation of hostilities in 2006. Lebanon's, Hezbollah's violent actions against fellow Lebanese citizens in May 2008 provide a fresh reminder of the threat the group poses to peace and stability. Our position on Hezbollah remains unchanged. It was designated as a foreign terrorist organization in 1997. We see no distinction between the leadership and funding of the group's terrorist, military, political, and social wings. We share this committee's strong support for the Special Tribunal on Lebanon, which opened on March 1st. We're confident that the tribunal will bring the murders of Rafiq Hariri and other Lebanese to justice. The tribunal is an independent body. It should not be politicized. And we agree, Mr. Chairman, there will be no deals at the expense of justice. In terms of the Lebanese armed forces, we're encouraged that the Lebanese state continues to strengthen its authority throughout the country, continues to expand its authority across all the Lebanese territory, with considerable help from Lebanon's international partners, including the United States. In this regard, particularly for the security services, I want to thank again Congress for providing the resources to allow us to be a partner with the Lebanese security services. Our assistance to the Lebanese armed forces has helped it respond more quickly and effectively to isolate outbreaks of violence throughout the country, prevent additional rocket launches, and discover more arms caches in South Lebanon. Our partners, the Lebanese armed forces, have proven highly professional, and our assistance continues to be used responsibly and with exemplary end-use monitoring, as noted in our regular reporting on this issue. As noted by the chairman and by some of you, I recently traveled to Syria with Dan Shapiro, who's the senior director for the Middle East and North Africa of the National Security Council. As Secretary Clinton stated, as many of you have urged, we are not engaging with Syria simply for engagement's sake. Our policies toward Lebanon are unshakable. We hope to use continued dialogue with Syria, in fact, to press for the need for non-interference in Lebanon, to urge progress on unimplemented parts of the Security Council Resolutions 1559, 1680, and 1701, and to address other pressing regional concerns, such as Iraq. We do support Israeli and Syrian efforts to reach a peace agreement, and we also hope that Lebanon and Israel can find a mutually acceptable mechanism to address their outstanding issues, including full implementation of Security Council Resolution 1701. We're prepared to support any dialogue, any mechanism that the parties agree is acceptable. We're pleased to see, in fact, that Israel and Lebanon are already engaged indirectly through the UN over the situation in South Lebanon, including Gaza, the village of Gaza. But to repeat what the chairman said, as we invigorate our efforts to achieve a comprehensive regional peace, no deal will be made at Lebanon's expense. In conclusion, I'd like to note that the pro-independence forces in Lebanon tell us consistently of their appreciation for the clear support they receive from members of Congress, as demonstrated by many of your visits and your statements, and from the administration. That support, which is bipartisan, must continue. Along with its other partners, the United States will continue to support the Lebanese people in their goal of a fully sovereign democratic state, where the government of Lebanon is the one exercising control over the territory of Lebanon. This is a vital goal for the Lebanese, and it will help achieve peace and stability throughout the region. Thank you for your time. It is a real honor for me to appear before you today, and I'd be pleased to address your questions. Thank you. Ambassador, one of the issues that has provoked Syrian threats against Lebanon in the past forces along the border of the two countries. At the same time, we know by independent means that Syria continues to arm Hezbollah across its frontiers, Lebanon, contrary to the mandate of the Security Council. The question is, what can the United States and what can the international community do to stop the flow of arms and to get Damascus to accept the delineation of the Lebanese-Syrian border? Mr. Chairman, you have touched on one of the biggest challenges we face in trying to support the implementation of Security Council Resolution 1701 that basically called for an end to all arms shipments to any group except for the government of Lebanon. Those arms coming from Iran are also, of course, a violation of other Security Council resolutions, such as 1747, that prohibits Iran from shipping weapons. These weapons not only are destabilizing, not only have a destabilizing effect in the region, but they endanger Lebanon itself, is our firm belief. We have had an ongoing dialogue with the government of Lebanon about how to address this problem. It's not just the United States that's concerned, it's all of Lebanon's international partners. In fact, many of Lebanon's international partners came together in two ways. One was to support a Lebanon border assessment team, Lebanon International Border Assessment Team from the United Nations that went out twice to study the problem you described and to identify possible fixes to this. The second thing that we did internationally was we came together to set up a model program for integrating Lebanon's security services, providing them support, technical assistance, in order to build a border patrol regime starting on the north. That effort is still underway, but the big concern is to the east. We would urge that the problem begin to be addressed, first of all, by Iran and Syria complying with their obligations under the Security Council resolutions not to permit arms transfers to unauthorized goods in Lebanon, but second, to do the border demarcations you mentioned. To control a border, you need to know where that border is. The Lebanese have stated their willingness to start that border demarcation immediately. They have reactivated their side of the joint border control. We would hope that Syria would respond in reactivating its side of the border control. I assure you this is one of the issues that we discussed when we visited Damascus a few weeks ago, because this is a very, very serious concern and a real deficiency in the implementation of 1701. In mid-March, President Bashar al-Assad gave an interview in which he issued veiled threats against Lebanon should the Harare Tribunal reach the supposedly wrong conclusions, or should the March 14th coalition win the elections and actually attempt to govern as a democratic majority. Questions. Do you believe that violence remains a part of Syria's strategy for dealing with Lebanon? What can we do to put the Syrian regime on notice that interference with Lebanon's elections will have consequences? Is it a good idea to tell them now what those consequences would be? And do we even know what those consequences are? You know, our concerns with Syria, we have very, very serious concerns with Syrian behavior. In Lebanon is one area of those concerns. When Dan Shapiro and I went to Damascus, Lebanon, of course, is one of the issues we discussed. Although one doesn't normally talk about what happens in diplomatic channels, I will take the liberty to say that Foreign Minister Walid Mualim, Presidential Advisor Bethana Shaban, Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad assured us that Syria shares our goal for elections in Lebanon that are free and fair, where the Lebanese people are able to choose their own representatives in parliament away from intimidation and violence. Now those were words, those were a statement, but they were said in a very important official bilateral dialogue. All of us are very aware of problems in Lebanon as the date for elections approach.
let me just say that my time is up. The witness will be allowed to finish the answer, and I'm trying to set a pattern. Please continue.
All of us are very aware of problems that have occurred in Lebanon in the past as elections approach. In fact, if you remember, the assassination of Prime Minister Rafik Hariri happened just a few months before the scheduled 2005 legislative elections. All of us are watching this very, very closely. It would be, you know, I won't speculate now on what the consequences would be of violence in Lebanon, but I am sure there would be an international reaction should these elections be marred in the same way that there was an international election in 2005.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm going to start off with this observation, because it's something we forget, but it does not negate the fact of how tough we need to be. And that is, Syria did play a positive role years ago in helping end the conflagration that was causing so much bloodshed and seemed so out of control at that time. I remember it very well. And when dealing with the Syrians, I think that we need to, if we're going to make a deal with these guys that will protect Lebanon, we've got to make sure that they understand that we are not forgetting that, because that's something that they, they have a right to be proud of, that they helped stop that bloodshed and turmoil. Of course, since then, their role degenerated into a very negative role in Lebanon. I just would like to ask you this. Is there, you were talking about what we expect. We expect the border to be controlled and such. What can we offer the Syrians that will be, if there's, is there a quid pro quo that we can offer them? The fact that they say they want to have free elections in Lebanon, quite frankly, if coming from a government that doesn't permit free elections in their own country, that doesn't hold much weight with me. What quid pro quo can we offer the Syrians in order to bring peace to Lebanon?
Congressman, if I can comment first on a more general part, noting how you opened your question, framing it in reminding us of the Syrian role in helping to end Lebanon's tragic civil war. You know, I think all of us would welcome very positive ties between Syria and Lebanon. It's natural that these two neighbors should have very strong bilateral ties. There are economic reasons for doing so. There's family reasons, people going back and forth. There's lots of historic reasons, cultural reasons. All of us would like to see very, very positive Syrian-Lebanese relations. Relations that are based on the idea of mutual respect, relations that are based on diplomatic recognition, which now has, in fact occurred. And I think all of us were pleased to learn that the Syrians have now sent the request for Agrément for the very first Syrian ambassador to ever be posted in Lebanon. This is all good news. To the extent that you have normal relations between Syria and Lebanon, that's great. And that Syria will have influence in Lebanon. Through the economy, through the family ties, through history. We're not saying no Syrian influence in Lebanon. So let it be a natural positive influence, the way that the U.S.-Canadian relationship works.
Mr. Nelson, that's a very good point. And I think it's an important for us to make sure that we assure, reassure the Syrians that if there is a regional peace, they will prosper.
Yes.
And they will be part of that. And our goal, of course, isn't to put Syria down. Our goal is to bring a regional peace and bring about an environment where you can have democratic government. Perhaps they could have democratic government in Syria as well, I might add. So are you optimistic that message can get through? Because I've heard that there is movement going on. We've all heard these rumors. Is there movement going on towards that direction?
Towards
Syria actually being willing to make the agreements, for example, the Golan Heights and the agreements about Lebanon that will bring about a regional
were 4 rounds of indirect talks between Syria and Israel that took place over the course of the past year that were brokered by Turkey. This is a positive sign of both Syria and Israel wanting to explore with each other how to get to a Syria-Israel track that's viable. The president, the secretary, I think Congress would like to see a comprehensive peace in the Middle East. It's been a bipartisan policy for many, many administrations. So to the extent that you can get a Syria-Israel track going, not at Lebanon's expense, I think that's all positive. I think that's what the Syrians are looking for us to help
work on. We need to be very tough on one side and very open-handed on the other. And I would hope, and Mr. Ambassador, I want to congratulate you and thank you for what you personally have done and used your influence to try to see that there are positive changes in that region. You've dedicated your life to these things, and those of us, it has not escaped us here in Congress. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Ambassador. Regarding Hezbollah, what concrete steps do you think the Lebanese leaders can take internally to help promote disarmament of Hezbollah?
I think the question of Hezbollah actually requires larger thinking than simply inside Lebanon. I think the Lebanese have a responsibility, but it also requires the international community and regional partners to work together. The goal, I think, should be that all parties in Lebanon compete democratically through elections, through normal means. And you don't have one party that's able to change the equation by threatening its arms or intimidating others because people know they have these kind of arms. The Lebanese government has taken some important steps since 2006, such as redeploying the Lebanese armed forces to the south. For the first time since the late 60s, the Lebanese armed forces are present on Lebanon's south border. And if you look at the number of incidents, security incidents between Lebanon and Syria, they're at their lowest level from 2006 until now, compared to the period from 2000, Israel's withdrawal from South Lebanon, until the war in 2006. The Lebanese have also committed themselves to a national dialogue process to discuss how to best defend Lebanon, how to build up the Lebanese institutions that can provide for Lebanese security. I don't think that there's an easy answer from today until tomorrow. It also requires work on the part of Syria and responsible behavior on the part of Iran. I'm optimistic that we're headed in the right direction. The biggest enemy to Hezbollah's arms is a strong, viable, responsible, accountable Lebanese state. I think that's what the international partners are trying to do in helping the Lebanese establish.
Thank you. In that same regard, strengthening cities and rural areas outside of Beirut city center is an important task toward reducing popular support of armed militias operating outside the mandate of the central government, such as Hezbollah and other extremist organizations. How can the Lebanese government continue to strengthen cities in rural Lebanon so that they can have their own freestanding, strong institutions?
It's an excellent question. You have pointed out something that not only gives Hezbollah strength, but also allows other sort of more traditional leaders or other groups to get loyalty of constituencies at the expense of government institutions. I think what the international community is trying to do in response to requests from Lebanese officials, Lebanese members of parliament, Lebanese civil society leaders, is help strengthen government institutions at the national level all the way down to the local level so that they are transparent, they are accountable, they are responsible, so that the Lebanese feel that if they need protection, their state can protect them. If they need water supply, utilities, they can go to their municipal officials and get them. They don't have to go to tribal leaders, to communal leaders. They can rely on the government. All of us are trying to help the Lebanese build the state institutions, the municipal institutions that a democracy requires to thrive. And I do think we've made some progress there. With the support of Congress, we have some very good programs working with municipal governments to make them more transparent, to do constituent outreach so that the local citizens can see what they're doing. We're working on improved water resources in the South in a way that the constituents can see what their government is delivering. These are the sorts of activities that I believe the international community is right to support with the government of Lebanon, and I'm very proud that we as the United States have been participating in this effort.
With my remaining seconds, Mr. Ambassador, you know, there was recently a report in the news about two Palestinian leaders who were killed in Lebanon. What can you tell us about that? What are the dynamics there, and what does it play?
I can comment on one. I'm not familiar with the second, but one that was killed was the second-ranking PLO official in Lebanon, a guy named Kamal Madhat. He was known for his moderation of trying to negotiate between Palestinian factions in these Palestinian refugee camps. He was PLO, he was effectively sort of mainstream Palestinian, trying to bring others on board to prevent violence from occurring in these Palestinian refugee camps, or worse, violence from spreading from the refugee camps outward. And I can only think that whoever decided to murder him using a explosive-laden car, like so many other assassinations in Lebanon, did not have the best interests of Lebanon or the Palestinian refugee camps at heart, because he's one that was trying to find nonviolent ways to address Palestinian concerns.
Thank you.
Mr. Burton, in person.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's nice being with you. I've been very concerned about Syria for a long, long time, because they appear to be the conduit for weapons coming in from Iran into Hezbollah and Hamas. And Hamas's headquarters is in, I believe, Damascus. What, if anything, can we do to convince Syria to become a member of the nations of the world that would believe in freedom and democracy, and to stop this support for Hezbollah and Hamas? And what can we do to get them to change their policies toward Israel? And if you can give me the answer to that, it's like cutting the wood or not, but I'd just like to hear your opinion. Kind of a tough question, huh?
It is a tough question, and if you look at Syrian behavior, in some ways they've tried to have it both ways, because they have in fact engaged on these indirect talks with Israel over the past year. Israel and Syria via Turkey had four rounds of indirect talks where they went into quite some detail about how they might move forward toward a peace agreement between the two, and I'm sure that security issues like Hezbollah and Hamas were among the issues that were discussed in these indirect talks. On the one hand, Syria has been willing to show that it will engage at least indirectly with the Israelis, and in fact, President Assad has referred that he's even willing to do this directly at some point. On the other hand, they are, in fact, the conduit for the arms shipments to Hezbollah, and also host the Hamas political leaders, who have been clear in their rejection of the conditions that would lead to Palestinian reconciliation, the condition that would lead to real Israeli-Palestinian peace. So I agree with you. They're playing a double role right now. One of the reasons why the President and Secretary asked Dan Shapiro and me to go to Damascus was to start talking about moving on the positive side, moving away from the less constructive behavior that they've been engaging in. It was one round of talks. I can't say that we have found the secret to this untangling this Gordian knot after 1 4-hour meeting. But nevertheless, it was the spirit of your question that the President asked us to go.
The President has indicated he would like to talk to the leaders of almost all of the Middle Eastern countries, in particular Iran and Syria. What do you think should be the preconditions before
the president does it. He gave a speech here, I think, last week, almost directly to the people in Iran, and he was rebuked by, I think, one of their cleric leaders, the Ayatollah Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran. He said that Obama has insulted the Islamic Republic of Iran from the first day. So this was after President Obama made those overtures to the Iranian people. What do you think that this country and this administration should do to try to open dialogue, if they should, and what should the conditions be, not only for Iran, but also Syria?
Well, I don't believe the engagement is soft. I don't believe that talking has to be a sign of weakness. Talking is one tool. In terms of Iran and Syria, let me just interrupt you a little bit. There's a number of people in the Congress, myself included, that believe, unless the conditions are very, very stringent, that talking to Iran is a sign of weakness to them, and that they are going to gain from just the very fact that the talks are taking place. So what I'm trying to figure out is what should be the parameters, and why should we be talking to them until there's something to talk about?
I think that the Supreme Leader's reaction that you quoted indicates that they're not looking at talking as a sign of weakness on our part. The fact that he has to make some critical comments about what was a New Year's greeting indicates that they're a little bit off balance by this. I would advocate that we, let me just, because my time's run out, I don't agree with that assessment at all. I think that they're recalcitrant, and I think they see a discussion with any of our leaders without very strong preconditions that deal with the problems in the Middle East would be a sign of weakness and would be an encouragement to them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Carnahan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome, Ambassador. It's great to have you here. I want to just start with a comment. NRC, the Times Run is a great opportunity to re-engage. I think like many of my colleagues and many Lebanese Americans that I represent, we hope to see a rebirth in the post-Civil War Lebanon. And so it's great to have you here. I wanted to, in terms of what we can do to strengthen the consensus government and Lebanese institutions, two in particular I wanted to ask about, and one is the Lebanese Armed Forces. You were here back in July of last year before the committee. You noted that the expansions of U.S. assistance to the LAF was to make long-term investment in the state of Lebanon and the security of the state, and the national institution that enjoys almost universal respect among the Lebanese. Can you tell us today if we've seen any improvement in the LAF performance since you were before us last year and in terms of how we should support that going forward?
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman Carnahan. The reaction of the Lebanese Armed Forces during the events in Gaza in January, I think, was illustrative. There was incredible pressure throughout the Middle East on moderate governments by what was happening in Gaza. You may remember hearing more radicals trying to attack moderate leaders and saying, now, wait a minute, we should be part of this fight. We should be siding with the Palestinians who are under siege in Gaza. We should be getting involved. Of course, moderate leaders in the Arab world realized that, you know, what in fact we needed to do was to try to get back to a ceasefire and get back onto a viable peace process. But there were elements trying to rile the street in a different direction. This pressure, of course, was felt in Lebanon, where there were 400,000 Palestinian refugees living in camps in Lebanon. There were, in fact, it was three rockets fired from South Lebanon into Israel during the Gaza crisis. This risked putting Lebanon and Israel at war again. The Lebanese Armed Forces, working with UNIFIL, immediately stepped up their patrols. They immediately issued statements, along with the Lebanese president, the Lebanese cabinet, unanimously on the part of the Lebanese cabinet, showing their support for 1701, their commitment to the resolution 1701 that provided for security and stability in South Lebanon. There were no further rocket attacks in South Lebanon. This is one example of the Lebanese armed forces stepping up to its responsibility to secure the South Lebanon border, where the Lebanese army had been absent from the late 60s all the way up until the fall of 2006. There's a long way to go, but I'll repeat what I said almost a year ago, which is that the Lebanese armed forces is the national institution in Lebanon that everyone takes pride in. There's not a Shia unit, a Maronite brigade. This is a cross-confessional organization that every family, every community is part of.
If I could, it comes up that one more institution I want to ask about, and that is the American University in Beirut, in terms of opportunities there to use that institution going forward in terms of better preparing them for success.
I have tremendous respect for the American University of Beirut. It's one of the outstanding institutions of education in the Middle East, and it's something I think we can all be proud of from the legacy of American benevolence in the 19th century. I had the opportunity last night, in fact, to meet the new president, new for me, he's been in office a few months, the new president of the American University of Beirut. And the U.S. Congress has been extremely generous in supporting the American University of Beirut over the years, and I expect that support will continue. But we work with the American University of Beirut in a variety of ways, but we also have to keep a little bit of a hands-off role from AUB because it is a private institution. It's not part of the U.S. government. So we support AUB while also letting AUB thrive as an independent academic institution.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador, a lot of subjects to go through, and I'll try to be quick and brief, but let me start in reverse order with AUB. Historically, AUB has had a total support in the words of the United States, both at the administration level and at Congress's level, but they've often had to be earmarked, a word that has become a little distasteful. Do you expect this administration to provide funding without separate earmarks from the Congress for AUB?
I would expect that we would have consistent support for AUB. It's in our interest to see that institution thrive.
I appreciate that. I'm glad to hear it. The history of military equipment, and it's a leading question, but I hope you'll appreciate in the vein it's given. When I go to Lebanon and I see M113s that were from before I started the Army in the 1970s, is it relatively true or completely true that no major piece of equipment has ever been lost by the Lebanese armed forces through all these years that was entrusted to them through our aid programs?
You're asking me easy questions, Congressman, but it is true. The Lebanese Armed Forces has one of the best track records in the world for this. Our end-use monitoring has revealed no deficiencies.
Excellent, and I appreciate that because we do have some portion of that $1 billion still backed up and not yet delivered to them. Probably one more softball, and that is there a win-win in your opinion dealing with the Litani and the Hasbani River to try to bring water to the south while at the same time allowing more water to flow into Israel if we're able to eventually engage in those projects in some constructive way? I know that's always been a can-we-go-that-far-south question.
This is far from a softball question, Congressman.
Water never is easy, even in Southern California.
We had a program with the Litani Water Authority several years back that we've now recently reinvigorated. It is extremely important for all the regions of the Middle East, but particularly in that part of Lebanon, to utilize the resources that are available to their fullest extent. We're looking at wastewater treatment, wastewater reuse. We're taking a comprehensive approach of how to better utilize the resources available in South Lebanon. But it's about Lebanon. This is part of our program for Lebanon. What we're doing is to help provide resources, better use of resources inside Lebanon. It's what
I appreciate it. I only brought up the question of Israel because there was some threat of bombing a pumping plant some years ago based on Israel's belief that Speaker Berry had funded a project that might be denying them some water, and that sensitivity, I think, hit the press. During the 2006 war and also during the run-up to the election or determination and election of the president, there was an attempt by a number of groups to sort of tear at the fabric of Lebanese society, and it certainly to us on the outside, it appeared to fail. Can you confirm that, in fact, all these attempts to tear apart the Lebanese and put them back into civil war have consistently failed? This is mostly a question of, are they durable running up to the parliamentary elections?
It's worth going back to that spring of 2005. You know, February 2005, the most powerful political figure in Lebanon was assassinated. The strongest Sunni leader in Lebanon was assassinated. The most renowned figure on the international stage in Lebanon was assassinated when Rafik Hariri was killed on February 14th. I expected whoever did that thought that it would scare the Lebanese, perhaps send them into civil war, but it would derail the elections that would come up. What happened instead? The Lebanese people pulled together, the international community pulled together, and in fact the Syrians had to leave Lebanon at the end of April, and there were free and fair elections at the end of May and in June of that year. I think the Lebanese people have pulled together repeatedly. There have been security breaches. There have been other assassinations. There have been murders of followers of certain political leaders. And every time this has happened, with the exception of May last year was an exception, but all these security incidents have not, in fact, led to broader civil war. They have led to the Lebanese stepping back and saying, now, wait a minute, let's solve our differences through democratic means, not through violence.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have your indulgence just for one quick follow-up question.
We'll allow that.
Okay,
in a moment, if I get a positive response from the ambassador. We've each had our turn. Your appearance was highly heralded, and you did not disappoint. If you would agree, I would go one more round of one question each with the members of our panel. And if my colleagues will indulge Mr. Issa, I'll let him take his question as his follow-up.
Thank you all. Mr. Ambassador, cluster bombs from the 2006 war, an estimated million of them that still, some portion of them still are in the south, mostly in the south of Lebanon, and serve as sort of bad examples of landmines because they're not designed to go off or not go off at a particular time. Can you give us a progress report and two other portions to it? You know, not only how well are we doing, but what effect is it having, and what do you think more the Congress should do to deal with the residue of that war?
Yeah, as of course you know, I was in Lebanon during that war and for the first, I guess, 18 months after that war. It was tragic to witness the civilian casualties during the war and then it continued on after the war. I'm glad that we've been able to respond. With the support of the Congressional Appropriations, we have so far provided over $15 million, $15.5 million or something, for the cleanup of what they call ERW, the explosive residue of war. And $13 million of that has gone directly to my advisory group to actually do the cleanup. But I think a more important part of it is $2.5 million that has gone to the Lebanese Mine Action Center, because this is about building capacity for the Lebanese, because unfortunately the mines and the cluster bombs were not only from the 2006 war, which we're addressing systematically, but there's also all sorts of unmarked mines remaining from the Civil War. And so by building up the capacity of the Lebanese themselves to clean it,
we hope we can keep the effort beyond just the South in the 2006 war. The other thing, of course, is we have always encouraged the Israelis to share all their strike data with the UN. The Israelis have told us that they have shared strike data on two occasions, including the data that they provided to their own troops when they were withdrawing in 2006. I took note in the Secretary General's most recent report on Lebanon, his most recent 1701 report, that there's a reference to the possibility of Israel providing more strike data. I don't have any way to confirm that now, but it would be encouraging if it's true. In terms of the actual cleanup and progress report, much of the South has been cleaned, but there are still additional discoveries of cluster munitions, so it still does provide a danger.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ambassador Hezbollah in Syria said that regardless of who wins the election in June, that Lebanon should have a government of national unity, one wherein the minority possesses a blocking third, in other words, the ability as they have now to veto all major government initiatives. On ruling March 14th coalition was compelled in May of 08 to accept this condition, but doesn't presently seem to have a cohesive position on that issue. Majority Leader Saad Hariri has announced that his future movement wouldn't participate in a Hezbollah-led government, but leaders of the other parties have indicated that they're nonetheless open to the idea. My question, does the Obama administration have an opinion or a position on this question?
Mr. Chairman, if you'll indulge me, I will give what I think is, I'll give you the position, but I'd also like to offer a personal observation on this.
Really appreciate that.
The position is that the Syrians shouldn't be talking about this, that none of us should be talking about this, that this is what the Lebanese should be deciding. Our whole policy has been bipartisan. Congress and administration for the past several years has been the Lebanese need to decide what's best for Lebanon. We have worked to create the atmosphere internationally in which the Lebanese have the space to maneuver, the room to maneuver, to make these decisions for themselves. So first and foremost, it's a decision for the Lebanese to make.
That's assuming they have the space.
Assuming they have, yes. And it's important for us to keep the space by emphasizing and finding ways to keep that space open. My personal observation is that for those who advocate this national unity type government that you describe that exists now, I would hope they would be telling their friends that are in the government of Lebanon now to make this government work. If people believe that this is an ideal solution for Lebanon, it doesn't seem to be operating ideally in practice, because the idea of having consensus for all government decisions has led, in what is my personal view, to many, many blockages in the work of the government.
Thank you. Mr. Rohrabacher, for one question, no semicolons, complex clauses or part B.
So we've determined that it would be in the last round that we would be well served by trying to convince, if we could, Syria and to serve their own interests by becoming a very positive player than a negative player. In the long run, that would serve. There is your carrot. Okay, now I'm going to ask you about sticks. Because I've noted that sometimes when you're dealing with tough guys rather than democratic leaders, which is what we're dealing with in Syria, the tough guys sometimes only understand the sticks and the fact that you're willing to use them. My read from their testimony is that we've got Iran in a relationship with Syria, which has a relationship with Hezbollah and Hamas, which is a negative influence in Lebanon. And in fact, Syria has a direct negative influence in Lebanon. So what are the sticks that we can use? First of all, Syria is a poor country. It doesn't have water and power sufficient, so it's a very relatively vulnerable country that way. What sticks would you suggest that we use if they are not convinced so we can all prosper and live at peace and there will be harmony in this area. But they aren't swayed by that. What sticks can we use to pry Iran and Syria apart? Because obviously, being a poor country, Syria depends on Iran. And then how can we make sure that we pry apart Hezbollah and Hamas from Syria? And what sticks would we use to accomplish that?
You know, I don't believe that many countries would envy being in the position Syria is in right now. Syria's best friend is Iran. Who are Iran's friends? Nobody seems to trust Iran in the region or globally. There are people who deal with Iran, but there's a lot of distrust based on Iranian misbehavior domestically, regionally, internationally. You know, there are a number of sanctions, designations that Syria belabors under now, that Iran also was under. Syria is designated as a state sponsor of terrorism. But these are fairly significant measures that are existing in the relationship with Syria now. I don't know if we will succeed in convincing Syria by words that it's worth changing direction, looking at different things. But I also don't think it's a sign of weakness to try. The Syria-Israel track that the Turks were promoting is a very intriguing one. We have long said we want a comprehensive peace in the region. That means peace between Israel and all of its neighbors. I don't believe that you can get to a peace between Israel and Syria as long as you have Syria giving the sort of support to Hezbollah and Hamas that it's giving now.
Particularly, they don't have any sticks.
I'm not using that language, but I would say look at the context in which the relationship with Syria.
Let me give you one document.
I'm trying not to go into
all right. Just one last thing.
You're doing good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How about if the non-democratic government of Syria continues to be playing a negative role rather than coming out and joining us and trying to play a positive role? How about if we support people who want to overthrow the government of Syria? Maybe they might be willing to compromise more if we were willing to put that kind of pressure on them. The same with the mullahs in Iran. I'm not talking about invading their country. I'm talking about supporting the democratic elements within those countries.
I had a no-hit ago, and you threw a spitball.
I'll just leave it with that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burton. I want you, Mr. Chairman, to define what one question is one of these days. It sounded like to me it was a small book. Anyhow, I don't mind. I thought they were good questions. I do have one question. You know, if we're talking about our leadership on this committee or the White House or the leaders like yourself or people in the State Department, if we believe that the leadership should talk to Syria about them becoming a non-terrorist state and becoming a member of the family of nations and helping solve the problems not only with Syria but Lebanon as well, shouldn't we, prior to any kind of discussion, talks, or meetings, require that Hezbollah and Hamas be removed from Syria as not only irritants but a problem for the entire Middle East and particularly Israel? And also, since Syria wants us to facilitate Israel getting the Golan Heights back, shouldn't all those things be part of some kind of an agreement before we have talks at a high level? Council Burt, let me be clear. Our policy is that Syria should stop supporting Hezbollah, that Syria should stop facilitating arms and financial
transfers. Okay, we've already slowed down the movement toward talking with Syria. And I'm not criticizing my colleagues, but a number of my colleagues
have gone over there from this committee and others to meet with Assad, and pretty much with no preconditions. So what I'm saying is, shouldn't there be something pretty well understood before they make these high-level talks, in particular with the president, before any of that takes place?
The approach the administration is taking right now is to see if we can use talks along with the other tools we have to try to get to the same policy goals. We share the same policy goals you described. Syria should stop supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. Syria should play a constructive role in the region. We have a number of tools at our disposal. Diplomacy is one of them. Talking is one of them. It's not a tool of softness or of weakness. It's a way to see if we can use a different tactical approach to achieve the same goals. One of the reasons, in fact, my own trip to Damascus went the way it did was to be able to demonstrate that our underlying policies aren't changing just because we're talking to Syria. I went to Beirut first. I wanted to see a number of Lebanese leaders, to talk to them not only about Lebanese elections, things we've talked about today, but also to talk to them about our discussions with Syria. What were we trying to achieve? We were not going to make a deal at Lebanon's expense. We were not going to let Syria off the hook for Hezbollah. I then went to Damascus with Mr. Shapiro, then returned to Beirut to show again that even though tactically we're employing a different tool than we may have employed a year or two ago, that the basic policy goals of supporting the Lebanese state, of supporting policy and reconciliation, that with under the quartet principles, that trying to stop the arms race has been, these policy goals remain the same.
Mr. Chairman, let me just say this, that my wife is from that part of the world, and I would like to go to Lebanon and Syria, and I know she would. Her family's over there. And if we can ever reach some kind of an agreement on the preconditions for these discussions so that the United States will not look or appear to be weak and caving in, then I'll be one of the guys that will be wanting to go. But at the present time, I still feel, Mr. Chairman, that those preconditions have not yet been met, and we shouldn't be going into them until they are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. Ambassador, thank you for agreeing to be our witness here today and appearing without any preconditions. We thank you for your service, your major contribution to our discussion today, and for your continuing service to our country.